Hello and welcome to episode 82 of the Viva Albertos podcast. My name is John Fleming. I'm a writer and editor at Viva Albertos, joined once again by writer slash editor at Viva Albertos, Heather Simon.
Hello, everyone.
All right, you got to talk way louder
than the mic. I was leaning back. Hello, everyone. Sorry.
Yeah, we just had a discussion before we started recording about how Heather doesn't sit close enough to the microphone. It's like probably half the comments we ever get on the podcast are saying that we need to turn Heather's microphone up, not realizing that we're talking into the same microphone, and I just sit closer.
Well, I swear we're the same distance away. My voice just isn't like, projects as much for whatever reason.
It's just my booming, thunderous, Morgan Freeman-like narration provides a more full backdrop to, okay, I don't know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, we didn't do an episode last week. I was feeling a little under the weather. Heather here is a much tougher sort than I am, so she, of course, was ready for one, but I was a wimp, so it's okay, though. We have a lot to discuss. A lot's happened in the last 2 weeks. The Cardinals, who I believe were in first place, but by a game the last time we recorded, or within, like, half a game, something like that.
It's a game, but I think they have two games more, played.
Well, things have changed though at this point, because they're still in first by, I believe it's a game or two games, or you would think we would look this up beforehand, but whatever.
I just saw it. They were up by a game, but they have played two less games, I believe, because there's two less in the loss column.
Yeah. However, a big key to that though is the team that's in second place is the Milwaukee Brewers. The team's in third place is the Cincinnati Reds, and it's the Chicago Cubs who are the prohibitive favorites going into the season from people that are not Heather. I will concede a defeat on that one, but
I mean, it's not true yet, but it's just, I just enjoy that everything that I said that had to happen for the Cardinals to win the division is kind of happening right now. It's pretty fun for me.
Yeah, it's fun for me too, just speaking as a Cardinals fan, but
I feel like a genius.
Well, perhaps you are a genius, but we'll discuss that in a little bit. We'll get a little more detail there, but I think the first topic of discussion is something that really dominated a lot of, you know, especially on social media, a lot of the conversation surrounding the Cardinals over the last couple of weeks. It happened last Tuesday, and I know that there's a certain segment of people that are sick of talking about it, but I think it's something that we have not yet addressed on the podcast, and I feel like it's important to do so, which was the tweet that the Cardinals made from their team account last Tuesday. I think it was around 8 a.m. I didn't see the actual tweet when it went up. I saw the backlash to it, and Heather here wrote a very good piece about it, which I'm sure we'll link to in the episode, which it's possible we'll forget about that. So if you do forget, it's called The National Pastime, I think.
Our National Pastime. Craig helped me come up with a title because I had no idea what I should call it. So thanks to the site manager, Craig J. Edwards, for the assist and editing.
Yeah, it was a weak assist. It was like one of those like goalie assists in hockey where you pass it to a guy and a guy skates all the way down the ice and puts it in. Like, you did the heavy lifting. I'm sure Craig would concede to that one. But the actual tweet in question, for anybody who hasn't followed the story, I realize not everybody who listens to the podcast is on Twitter or is particularly, you know, in tune with every development in Cardinal social media. The tweet that was sent out, it was advertising the promo item that's actually at the game on Wednesday, this upcoming Wednesday, for a replica 1967 World Series championship ring. And the tweet reads, along with a picture of it, "You love baseball, she loves jewelry. On May 17th, it's a win-win." I mean, the obvious implication there is marketing towards men who are interested in watching a baseball game, and implying along the way that women would be less interested in the actual baseball game and want jewelry. And I think there's a few different sort of ways you could view the tweet in terms of what they were going for. I don't think any of them particularly positive towards the Cardinals. They ended up deleting the tweet, and they offered, I would say, sort of a
sorry you were offended
apology. Yeah, it was a very much a half apology.
That was almost worse than the tweet, I think.
Yeah.
I just hate when people, if you're going to apologize, then you clearly did something wrong. So just apologize and don't put all these disclaimers. They almost apologize more for confusing people than they did about the actual offense of the tweet.
Yeah, but as far as the actual offense of the tweet, obviously, we don't want to just repeat every word you said in your post. I guess if it was a good post. I guess if you really want to, you can. But Heather, obviously, I'm sure this isn't a huge shock to people listening, but you are a woman who is enough of a baseball fan that you write for a baseball blog. I am not a woman, so obviously I view things from a somewhat different perspective, especially on this topic. So just what was your reaction just to the tweet and in terms of like the underlying messages that it sends?
Well, my initial reaction is that it's not a very good advertisement to begin with, because what kind of woman that isn't interested in baseball looks at that giant replica ring and goes, yes, that is the jewelry that I want?
Yeah, like you could you could literally probably go to a Walmart and put a quarter in a little machine and get a nicer looking piece of jewelry if you strip it of all of its symbolism.
Right. So that, first of all, I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Second of all, this is where people get confused, I think, in that they say, well, it's not that bad. Why are people offended by it? And it isn't that bad. There are much, much worse things that have happened in baseball. That's not the point. The point is that it's just another thing in a long list of things that, I guess they're called microaggressions, I think.
The term microaggression, it was originally used like in academia to describe things that get on people's nerves. It's sort of been used sort of like in the way that people use the term like snowflake now, or it's used as sort of this sarcastic, like mocking mostly millennials for being too sensitive or whatever, which I don't think there's anything I don't think there's anything wrong with giving consideration to other people's feelings, but
and like I don't get offended super easily or insulted super easily, but it was just really annoying. And it's one of those things, is a long, like, another thing that someone does that says that women aren't as big of fans as men. And it came from a team account, a team that I love very, very much and spend money on and, like, passionately follow. It's one thing when it's some doofus that says it, but when it's something that you cherish that tells you that you aren't as, you don't love them as much as someone else because of your gender or sex or however, then it's even more hurtful, I think, because I feel really betrayed. I'm like, oh, well, okay, I guess I'm not as big a fan, just, you know, I don't know. And I obviously don't think that, and I don't think that was what they intended to say. I think it was just supposed to be one of those cutesy little ha ha ha, women like jewelry, men like sports sort of things. And so I don't get too mad about it, but it's just that it's another one of those things saying that women don't belong. And then it has the weight of an official team behind it. And that makes it more aggravating, I think.
Yeah. If this had been the first case in the history of baseball where female fans were being put on the back burner, that I could see where you would just sort of let it go. But it's on top of a lot of different things that have happened, and not just from the Cardinals. Obviously, it's not like it just started with Twitter either. It's been a thing for a long time. I've at least like considered the possibility that the intention of the tweet, and I don't think this would happen, but I'd say there's at least like a 5 or 10% chance that this was the case, was almost a sort of like a meta joke where it's sort of, you know, playing up sort of the idea and like making an intentionally over the top sexist tweet, where like obviously, as you mentioned before, it doesn't make any sense to market a World Series replica ring towards jewelry fans. Like it's clearly just for baseball fans. But the problem with doing that though is you're still at that point you're making light of all of the ways in which women fans have been pushed aside and have been treated as lesser fans inherently. And you mentioned several different stories in your piece, and again, people can read that, but of, for instance, like going to a store buying a Cardinals hat and somebody saying, and I don't know if this was specifically your story or if it was a story from one of the other women that helped contribute stories, but saying your boyfriend's going to love it, when it was a hat that was being purchased for the person buying it, which is a very strange assumption to make. I must say, I bought you a hat for your birthday, and the person at the at the store did not say, "Oh, hey, I'm sure your, you know, friend, significant other of the opposite sex is going to enjoy it." I'm sure they assumed that I was buying it for myself, which, you know, it's a fair assumption, but it's also a fair assumption whenever a woman's buying it. And it's a strange idea, though, just purely from a marketing perspective, ignoring the social ramifications, but the total number of baseball fans that are women, like, women are a minority of baseball fans, but not by much. It's like 40-45% is the numbers that I've heard. And the idea that you would ignore that group of people is just very strange. I'm really not sure who this tweet was serving. Like, you'd have sort of the people talking about, you know, political correctness run amok who were defending the tweet after there was controversy to it. But I don't think anybody, whenever it came up, was saying, "Oh, this is a really funny tweet. Oh, this is a really good idea." Like, it doesn't serve any actual purpose. This isn't like we're debating a joke that, like, a stand-up comedian tells, and we're weighing the offense that it causes versus the humor of it, because there is no humor to it. It's just a dumb sort of observation that doesn't really have any sort of weight.
And that plays into another thing that I had been thinking about when the tweet was tweeted, is that if there had been some woman's input along the line, there's no way that that tweet gets posted. Because you can tell right away, a woman would have been like, "No, you shouldn't do that." And maybe they had a woman's input and ignored it, or maybe she said, "Yeah, go for it," but I doubt it. I just cannot see a woman saying, "Yeah, that's going to work. That'll be fine." I just can't see it.
Yeah, we don't know exactly who sent the tweet. There was one person's name who was mentioned a lot, I saw afterwards, accusing them of making the tweet for the account. But I think there's more than one person running the account, so I'm not going to, you know, chastise that one person. Also, I don't want to make it seem as though if this one person were called out and their name were dragged through the mud, that all of a sudden this attitude would stop. Because this attitude is clearly more than one person. It's clearly more than one team account. But, like, as soon as I saw I saw the controversy of it and people criticizing it before I saw the actual tweet. But one of the first things I thought was, oh, Heather is not going to like this. Like, it's not even that it's going to make her mad, but it's going to make her upset. It's going to make her feel like she's being minimized, which is
exactly what it did.
Totally nonsensical. And one of the people that helped you with your story, our recapper, Gail, was sort of telling the story on Twitter about how she feels like, you know, women fans have to just prove themselves more than male fans.
Oh, definitely. Where you say you like baseball and they ask you, "Well, what's the coach's son's team in college?"
You're like,
"I don't know. Tate Matheny played at Missouri State. Does that count?"
Yeah.
You know, like,
I was going to say, I actually know the answer to that question.
That's what I thought of. Of course I picked one that I knew the answer to already. But it's stuff like that where if I get something wrong, I feel like I've just set women back 50 years in sports liking. It's a lot of pressure, especially like writing and having people read stuff that you're putting out there. It's kind of stressful.
Well, I think that's just generally true regardless of your gender. And certainly if you want to, you know, if somebody's like in the public eye and you want to criticize their, you know, baseball knowledge or something like that, then you have the right to do so. But don't do it more than you would for a man.
Right.
We've all written some things that are better than other things, and that's just kind of what it is.
There's just this added pressure that I feel like I have to represent all women sports fans, because if I mess up, then, like, with the Jessica Mendoza thing, if she was a bad analyst, which I think she's fine. I don't think she's any better or worse than a male analyst. But if she wasn't, I'm sure she felt this pressure to be really, really good at what she did. Because if she wasn't, then women can't be analysts. You know? Yeah. Which is not true.
Well, the difference between Jessica Mendoza and the vast majority of color... Let's just say Tim McCarver as an example, because he's been a prominent color commentator for many years. There's a lot of people that don't like Tim McCarver as a commentator, and people have a right to their opinion on that, but nobody's questioning Tim McCarver's right to be a color commentator. Yeah. Nobody's saying you're not allowed. Well, with Jess Mendoza, that comes up, and it's really done in a very strange way. And one thing that I know Gail had mentioned was she'll occasionally mention on Twitter, like, ranking Cardinals players by hotness as sort of like a satirical thing.
Yeah.
Where you're sort of playing up this stereotype just to an over-the-top degree of, like, oh, women are just interested in watching cute baseball players running around or whatever. But also, I don't think that's a problem because I was thinking about this, like, the WTA in, like, the late 90s and early 2000s was marketing Anna Kournikova, who was sort of a so-so tennis player, certainly not the best tennis player on tour, but were marketing her like crazy as this very attractive woman towards men. And nobody was, like, you could sort of judge some of the men, obviously, but it's not as though every man who was watching the WTA was watching it for, you know, Anna Kournikova.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, if anything, those, like, the WTA has done a lot better marketing Serena Williams over the years, which, I mean, granted, she's an attractive woman too, but she's also dominant, and that's why people mm-hmm. are enjoying watching her for the most part. And when it comes to, like, baseball, occasionally you'll hear remarks about, like, Chris Bryant being marketed towards women, but he's also an MVP.
Right.
Like, that's why it's working. It's not like there's just some guy who's, you know, good looking, and then women are coming because of that. They're
not marketing Tyler Lyons, despite the fact that he's one of the yeah. more handsome people in Major League Baseball. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. They are kind of marketing Mike Matheny a little bit to the moms and stuff, but that's fine. Who cares?
Well, I think it's a little bit different because there just aren't that many marketable managers.
That's true. That's also true.
And there's not really quantifiable ways of evaluating a manager either. We tend to criticize Mike Matheny quite a bit, but it's not like there's a stat we really have to conclusively back it up.
That's fair, too.
But also, it sort of ventures into, like, judging fans on how they're fans. If a woman is watching baseball just because they think Tyler Lyons is pretty, that's not really, you know, why I'm watching baseball. It's not really why you're watching baseball, even if you agree with them. But there's also, like, if you go to a random woman at Busch Stadium, they're not going to know, like, the basics of how wins above replacement is calculated. They might not even know how OPS is calculated. But it's also true of the majority of men at the stadium. And it's just sort of this weird snobbery. And it's almost sort of like how people will criticize other fans for being bandwagoners. And, like, I get the logic behind it, but at the same time, you need those extra fans.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really, like, the growth of baseball is not going to continue if women are being cut off from it. You're going to need men, you're going to need women, you're going to need to expand that umbrella as much as you can. You're going to need fans of all sexes, races, sexual orientations, ages. And at this point, like, baseball, I don't think it's a secret, has a generally older average age than, I believe, at least any other major sport. Like, I think golf's probably older, but as far as, like, major team sports, nobody ventures older than baseball. And Twitter tends to veer a bit younger than the average age of baseball. So the fans are being marketed to. The main problem, and I've been talking for a long time, and I feel weird that I'm the one going on the extended rant, but if you have, I feel like what you're telling women, even if they don't directly take offense to the tweet, is that they're the anomaly. They're being told that you're different for liking this thing.
Oh, yeah, you get that a lot. Oh, you're different from other girls.
Not really, no. And even if you are, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, the idea that there's anything wrong with being a woman who likes baseball is completely crazy. I don't know what argument could possibly be made for that.
It just doesn't even make sense because there's nothing about anything about sports that says that only men should be able to like it. Like, what is there about baseball that's specifically for men? There's no peeing standing up contest or anything like that. So
really getting very bizarre with this. But yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? There's nothing gender specific about baseball. So there's no real reason why men should like it more. Everything that you love about baseball, a woman can, like, everything a man loves about baseball, a woman can also love about baseball.
This is sort of a moderate tangent, but have you ever been in a conversation with somebody about, like, favorite baseball movies, and then somebody asks if A League of Their Own counts as a baseball movie?
I have not, thankfully.
Because I've been in this conversation many times, and it's coming from people who were saying they like the movies. Like, does A League of Their Own count? Well, it's a sport about a baseball league. Like, how did that not count? Like,
I guess they think it's softball, but they're not.
No, they're not playing softball. They're playing baseball. Yeah,
baseball in skirts, no less. Have you seen some of those gnarly injuries of like those skirts? Those are awful. So that's why I always laugh when like you have like John Gibbons, like, yeah, we'd be playing in skirts. If you played in a skirt, you would not be saying that. It is freaking hard.
Yeah, they were. Like, the women who were in skirts in the 40s were very tough.
Yes.
is a very bizarre, and that's obviously neither here nor there when it comes to the tweet, but it does feel like there's, you know, marginalization that's happening here, and I don't think it's good. And, you know, the tweet was deleted. They did their sort of...
terrible apology.
Half-hearted apology.
Yeah, like I said, I think that's almost worse, because at least the original tweet... Like, the original offense is a mistake. The apology is supposed to apologize for the mistake. And so, when you mess up the apology, that's almost worse because that's the whole point of an apology. I just don't get why people just can't say they're sorry about things. I just don't understand. Sorry that we sent that tweet. Don't say sorry that some people were offended by the tweet. No, don't. Say sorry.
Well, you can be sorry that people were offended by the tweet, but you should also be sorry that you gave them reason to be offended.
Right. Say, I guess maybe this is pedantic, but we are terribly sorry we offended people instead of sorry you were offended.
No, I agree. And yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. The Cardinal social media has improved over the last year or so, but there's still room to grow. And like, I remember like the Blues had an incident where in their last series before they got eliminated in the playoffs against the Nashville Predators, there were some fans who were tweeting racist comments about one of their opponents, PK Subban, who's a black player. And the Blues account just immediately like stepped down, like, no, we're not going to tolerate that. Like, you can root against this guy all you want. We actively encourage you to root against him, but don't make this, you know, about racism. And, you know, people do that sort of thing to the Cardinals account too. And it's not just to the Cardinals account, and I don't. If it happens more to the Cardinals account than other teams, it's not by much. But the idea that they would step forward on that kind of thing is so unlikely, and yet they're also willing. They're also able to do these things that are, you know, specifically negative. And certainly, it's not the worst thing in the world. But it's not like people who are like researching cancer or something are being called off the case to investigate the bad Cardinals tweet. Like, we can focus on multiple things. And of course, there's the fact that of the people who were bemoaning PC culture and saying that it wasn't a big deal, a vast majority of them were men. And if you're a man, and I'm a man, like, we have a room at the table for this discussion, but you have to at least consider what's causing the offense. You can say that it's not a big deal, and maybe you're right, you have a right to your opinion, but, you know, at least listen. And people weren't willing to listen on it. They were just immediately shooting it down why it wasn't a big deal. And instead of explaining why you felt it wasn't a big deal, you were telling people why it wasn't a big deal. And I think there's really a huge difference between those two.
Yep.
All right. I think we've discussed the bad tweet long enough. Yes. But now to talk about happier Cardinals developments, we have... well, I guess, though, on sort of a similar note to sort of the casual sexism of the tweet was something you know more about this than I did because you wrote about it earlier today. But John Lester had some comments that were I can't remember the exact phrase you used to describe it. Oh, toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to explain what happened there, because you know the story better than I do?
Well, basically on Saturday, which my brother, congratulations, graduated then, so I didn't get to watch all of the games. So I didn't see the specific play, but I went back and watched the replay of it.
Ian Happ was sliding in a second. I watched the game, so I'll fill
what's
in.
What's his name? Because he's new. Ian Happ. I was going to say J.A. Happ, and then I was going to say Carter.
Well, it's J. Happ, because he pronounces it, I don't know, it's weird.
I knew that. I knew that, too. I always think it's the opposite of what it is, and then I always say it wrong. But then I was going to say Carter Caps, and yeah, I knew that wasn't right either.
The pitcher for the Rockies, I think, or the Padres, somewhere in the NL West, I don't remember.
So it's Ian Happ was on first base, and Anthony Rizzo was up to bat, and I think it was Schwarber on third. It doesn't really matter who was on third.
Yeah.
I don't know. For third base, whatever. Anyway.
It was runners on first and third, though, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, runners on first and third, and Ian Happ slid into second base, He slid way past the base, lost contact with the base, knocked into Alenis Diaz, who was trying to turn the double play. The umpires ruled that it was interference based on the collision rule that they came up with, was that two seasons ago?
It was following the incident where Chase Utley of the Dodgers at the time slid hard into Ruben Tejada, who was on the Mets during the NLDS in 2015.
Okay, so it would have been two seasons. Well,
it would have been basically a year and a half ago. Yeah,
this is the second season. It doesn't really matter. But yeah. It's been around for a full season at least. And he slid into Diaz. Diaz couldn't make the double play. He just kind of jumped over and ate it, basically.
Yeah.
Which was the smart thing to do, because if had he planted and thrown, he might have gotten hurt. And he
probably would have thrown it away, too, had it not been for the obstruction being called.
Right. And so they called obstruction, called Rizzo out at second, which means the run didn't score, which means the Cardinals maintained their 3-run lead. It's a bummer for the Cubs. Because, yeah, it's kind of, they lost a run on a technicality. Although,
I wouldn't say technicality, though. I mean, I think it was probably the right call. Like,
right. I'm just saying they didn't lose a run because of a play. They lost it on a rule, which is always going to kind of sting a little bit. I get that you're not happy with it, but I think it was the right call, too.
In a game that they lost by 2 runs, it should be noted.
Right, they didn't lose by 1. That and, like, I get that it isn't fun. No one likes to lose that way. But you have a choice on how you act after something like that happens. And you can either suck it up or you can whine. And if you're going to whine, you need to whine in a way that isn't horrible, I guess. Because when you whine and you talk about how the game is soft and everyone's a bunch of pansies.
And this was John Lester.
Yeah, Madden was still, Madden was whining, but it was more of, well, he was saying this too.
It was more general whining, not specifically,
like,
you know, questioning masculinity of the game.
Yes. I mean, and Madden was kind of doing that too, but it wasn't as overt as calling everyone soft and a bunch of pansies. The word pansies is like, kind of like the word thug, I would say.
Yeah.
There's a very discriminatory meaning. It's, or like the word,
There's a connotation to it.
There's a connotation. Like, it can go one of two ways, and neither is good at all. So, I don't even really know what the point of this is, other than it's just another example in baseball. Like, it's almost marginalizing another group of people again. Like, that's not, I don't know.
Yeah, and, like, personally, just speaking on purely baseball sense, like, the reason this rule was instituted was for player safety, and they're talking about this like it's a bad thing, which, I mean, I understand why John Lester's mad in that specific situation because it hurt his team, but, like, in the end, players are going to be safer because of it, and the idea that baseball shouldn't evolve is bizarre to me. Like, people get mad about the no collisions at home plate thing. You can argue whether or not the rule is enforced correctly, and I think that the rule has the right idea, but there's certain examples that sort of show that it's not really quite ingrained like it should be. But the overall idea is keep players safe. And it's not even a matter of, you know, toughness or softness or anything like that. It's to make the game better, because if players aren't getting hurt, the game's better. The game's better if Buster Posey doesn't have to miss, you know, several months of a season because he got barreled over at home plate because he's a good player. And so,
exactly. I don't get why anyone would not be in favor of keeping players safe. Especially grinds my gears, because when has John Lester ever been in an on-field collision? Like, who is he to say anything at all? That's what just kills me. Like, this guy who is never...
Well, he only gets hits against the Cardinals. He got a double on Saturday.
But he has never played middle infield or catcher, so I don't think he should be allowed to talk. Shut up.
I'm not positive he's ever slid.
No, yeah, seriously. I mean, and I don't want to bring this up because I don't want to minimize the offense of, like, what he said by making fun of the fact that he can't throw to first base.
I was going to say the same thing.
But he literally can't. He's literally afraid to throw to first base, but the game is too soft. Like, no, it's not. The game is not soft, and that's why I loved what Mike Matheny said. Like, he just... And people will argue with me whether he burned Joe Maddon or not. No, he just completely destroyed Joe Maddon. It was the best thing. It probably I'm not a Matheny fan, but if he's around and all he does is just burn Joe Maddon like that all the time, then I could probably live with it because it just made me so happy.
Yeah, we can criticize Mike Matheny's tactical ability or even his ability to deal with players, but if there's one area that I trust Mike Matheny on, it's to discuss the impact of collisions and mm-hmm. players getting hurt on the field, because his career was shortened by all accounts by the fact that he had these concussions. I don't know how much longer his career was going to go anyway because he wasn't much of a hitter, but as far as these concussions did take a toll on him. And the fact that he's standing up for player safety, you could argue that there's some level of hypocrisy because, you had, Matt Holliday whenever he barreled into Marcus Scudero in the 2012 NLCS, which you could argue it was legal, but he probably shouldn't have done it in terms right. of just general sportsmanship. Whether or not punishment was necessary, totally separate discussion, but the rules are as they are now for the sake of protecting players. It wasn't just the fact that Utley slid into Tejada that caused this rule. It was a culmination of many years of this sort of thing happening. And then one very egregious, high-profile incident at the tail end of this caused there to be a reconsideration of, what do we value? Do we value tough slides that are, way over the line? Or do we value player safety and making sure that the best players are able to play?
Yeah, and when you ask people why they like baseball, I can't think of one person that says, oh, for the collisions at second base. who says that? I value baseball for the collisions and any chance that a player gets to hit another player. No.
That's why I always found it funny whenever the intentional walk thing was being discussed, the automatic intentional walk thing. I can sort of see the argument either way for the new rule where you don't have to throw the four balls, but people were talking about that this was a sacred part of their baseball experience, was watching a pitcher intentionally pitch out four times softly.
I will argue just that in the spirit of the game, four balls is a walk. And
no, I agree with that. But
that's why I understand it. And it's part of it's an objection to change or a resistance to change, which shouldn't be.
But who was turned off of the sport because of it?
Though? Oh, yeah, that's definitely no one's going to protest baseball over something like that. But with this, it's just people that are like, I'm not going to watch baseball anymore. It's too soft. Well, then you didn't really like baseball because baseball is not about that. It's about kind of how I mentioned in an article. It's about, a hitter taking a fraction of a second to decide if he's going to swing at a certain pitch or decide if it's going to be a ball or strike or if it's going faster or slower than he thought. It's about, fielders making these incredible plays and pitchers throwing these pitches that you didn't even think were possible. There's so many great things about baseball, and none of them are seeing people get broken legs or careers derailed because someone slid into them like a jerk.
Yeah, I'm struggling to think of a team sport that has less contact than baseball anyway. It's not like
volleyball?
Yeah, I guess so, but I mean, guys, people get spiked in the face, and there's sort of the threat there, which I guess baseball's come back. Regardless, though, I mean, if people are watching a sport because they want maximum grit and toughness, they're watching football or hockey or rugby or something. They're not watching baseball for that.
Even then, that's kind of it. Almost offends me that people are say they're turned off by baseball because of that. Because baseball is so much more, and even football and hockey, there's strategy. It's just if you just want to watch someone hit someone. I don't know what the sport...
Boxing.
Boxing, maybe. But even then, their strategy. If you just want to watch something get hit, then maybe a demolition derby? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is here.
Some, reel of, NASCAR crashes? I don't know.
Right. Maybe you could just go punch a tree for a little bit, if that's your thing. I don't know.
It's bizarre. But I think when it comes down to it, it's important to remember that the reason that the Cubs were mad, the reason Joe Maddon and John Lester were complaining, beyond anything else, is they lost. And then they lost the next day, too. And the Cardinals ended up winning 2 out of 3 in the series. As we mentioned before, the Cardinals ended up winning. They are in first place. We may be getting a cameo from Heather's dog again, who appears to be scratching himself. I'm not sure how that's going to turn out, but we'll just talk loudly over it. But
I think he's clapping. He's excited for the Cardinals winning.
I'm glad. He's been trained well.
Yes. He's a Cardinals fan. He loves baseball.
Of course. as all good dogs do.
Yeah.
And he is a very good dog. Yes. But anyway, though, the Cardinals are in first place. Cubs are in fourth, as we all predicted. You can mock me all you want for the fact that I picked the Cubs, but you did not have the Cubs finishing in fourth place.
No.
And they won't.
If they do, I'd be incredibly surprised. There's a lot of baseball left, but let's just relish it while we still can.
If you had told me before the season to handicap the percentage odds of the Cardinals winning the division, I probably would have had it around, I don't know, 5-10%. Like, it would not, like, there would have been some odds, and they would have had the best odds of anybody in the division not called the Cubs, but it would have been pretty low. But, you know, things are working out here where you can kind of see where the Cardinals would have a path to it. Now, obviously, at this point, they don't have a big enough lead that I'm weighing that much into it, though it plays whatever factor it plays. But the Cubs, not just last year, but the year before, they made the NLCS the year before, and they had that wild card game. So the total number of games they play, let me try to remember. So they played 162 in the regular season, they played the wild card game, they played 4 in the NLDS, and then 4 in the NLCS because they got swept by the Mets. So they played 171 games last year, or in 2015. Then last year they played 161 in the regular season because they had that rain out. They played 4 in the NLDS, so 165. NLCS, I don't remember how long that went. Did that go 5 or 6? I don't remember. But the World Series ended up going 7. So at that point, you're approaching 180 games played. Like, this eventually takes its toll. And these are, like, not just additional regular season games being played. This is a lot of more energy being exerted than had previously been the case during the regular season. And these things do take their toll. Like, obviously, in the moment, you're going to take it. You're not going to say, oh, well, we better get knocked out of the playoffs so we can conserve for next April.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the season's a grind, and the more time you have to rest, the better off you are. You know, the Cardinals...
Especially for pitchers.
Yeah, and the Cardinals have that benefit. And you see that the Cubs' pitchers are really coming back down to earth. Like, John Lester's been fine, though not peak John Lester. Jake Arrieta's really struggled. He pitched yesterday. It was actually one of his better games of the season, which says more about his season than it does about him. And, you know, Kyle Hendricks and John Lackey are not pitching as well as they were the year before, having injuries with the number 5 spot. The lineup over this last weekend, Chris Bryan didn't play, so obviously that makes it look not as good.
Was he injured?
He was hurt, like a day-to-day kind of thing. He's not, like, on the DL or anything, though. But... And he's been awesome this season, but, like, Anthony Rizzo hasn't been as good. Kyle Schwarber, people were talking about him like he was going to just be the next Babe Ruth at the plate, and he has not materialized. Like, he's drawing walks. He hasn't been terrible. But in addition to the fact that he provides very, very poor defense, his offense hasn't been there. You know, Jason Hayward's hurt now. He was doing better than last year, but still not quite what they were expecting when they signed him. Like, Addison Russell's played well, Almora and Jay have played well, but overall, though, you look at this Cubs team, and, you know, once you make a few concessions, you know, of guys just regressing towards the mean, it just doesn't look as good. I still think they're a good team, don't get me wrong, but the idea that this is a team that's perennially going to win 100-plus games was always, I think, pretty foolish. And, you know, Cardinals have guys who are really coming into their own, and... You know, it's cherry picking to go, you know, sample sizes here, but once you remove the Cardinals starting the season 3-9, they've had the best record in baseball since then. You know, those 3-9 obviously count, but you can see where the Cardinals can really hit their stride. I've been talking for a long time, so I'm going to...
I agree. It's kind of what I said in the preview episode where I could see the Cardinals' path to division, and it wasn't... A lot of things would have to happen. And the big thing is the starting rotation for the Cubs. And that's not been as successful as they've had in the past few years. Another thing was Schwarber not being as good as people thought he was going to be. And that's kind of what happened as well. I mean, he might, like you said, regress. And by regress, I mean, like, move higher towards his...
Progress.
Yeah, progress. But... Then there's the Hayward's gotten better, like you said.
Well, he's hurt now, but he had been getting better, yes.
But there was a path for the Cardinals to be able to win the division, and we're kind of seeing the best case scenario. And then on the Cardinals side, they needed to have their starting pitching be excellent. They needed to have Fowler be good, which Fowler and Carpenter at the top of the lineup, which they're starting to really turn it around. Carpenter has had the really good on-base percentage and his power numbers are coming around now. They needed Colton Wong to take a step up, and it looks like he's really doing that. So everything that could go right for the Cardinals seems to be going right. Let's see how it changes as the season goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to have certain things work out, and some guys are not going to keep up the hot streak they had to start the season, but then other guys are going to step up and they're going to look better. Like Adam Wainwright yesterday, after he had some pretty disastrous starts to begin the season, like I would hesitate to call his start yesterday great, even though he didn't allow any runs. But
he walked four and I think struck out three or something. It doesn't look that great on paper, but I think he got a lot of ground balls is what I was reading.
He was better though, and he was pitching the contact a lot better too, because like leading into this, I haven't looked at the updated stats, but entering yesterday, his ERA was like 7 or so, and his fielding independent pitching was in the 3s. So like the shorthand version is you'd look at that and you'd say, well, he's going to pitch closer to the FIP than what the ERA was. But the way he was pitching though, he was just serving up meatballs. Like the BABIP was a bit higher than even you would expect with, batting practice pitchers. But at the same time, there was a reason that the BABIP was high, if not a reason it was that high.
I do recall some of his starts, too, being really good. And then in the last inning, something would kind of turn, and then they'd bring in, like, Cecil, and then all the runners would score.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, Cecil. But I remember a couple of starts, I'm like, man, Wainwright looked really good, and now all of a sudden his final line is ruined because inherited runners scored.
I'm having the hardest time evaluating Brett Cecil because people turned on him immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Like, within an appearance or two, and I was like, guys, just calm down. He had, but he keeps not having good appearances, so now I'm kind of like, so is he just, like, not good now? Because I don't want to jump to severe conclusions, because even so, he's still only pitched, like, less than, like, 2 starts worth of innings. Right. It's not like he's been racking them up, but it's not looked great. But like I mentioned before, Wainwright had a more favorable start in terms of run suppression yesterday. Whether that was sustainable or not, we'll let other people decide. But like at this point, if the season ended today, obviously the Cardinals would make the NLDS. Assuming that you could line pitchers up the way you would want them to, how would you rank the pitchers at this point in terms of starting games 1 through 4 in a playoff series?
As of now, Martinez.
Yeah, Martinez is my number one as well. Mm. And like he hasn't had the best results of everybody on the staff. That's been Mike Leake. But in terms of combining having good results, having good recent starts, even though he walked a few more guys than I would have liked in his last start. But generally speaking, I'm not super concerned about him.
He's still the most talented pitcher on the staff, so you have to get the most starts out of him. I'd probably go Martinez, Lynn, Leake, Wainwright. Or maybe I'd flip Leake and Lynn. I don't really know.
I'm very worried about Lance Lynn at this point. Like, his ERA is good. His ERA, I think, is like 2-something, but his peripherals are way up there, and I don't know. It's hard to, I think at this point, this almost seems crazy. At this point, I think I'd go Leake, too, just because, like, I know what I'm getting. Even though I don't think he's going to continue to be, like, the Cy Young pitcher he was in April, I think that he's steady, and I'm not super... Waka's pitched well, and when he's healthy, he generally does pitch well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was such a backlash because the praise for him was so over the top after the 2013 postseason, but like he's good, he's just not what he was in the 2013 postseason.
That's true. I kind of was discrediting Waka right away, but his curveballs looked pretty nice, actually. Like, it used to just be kind of a get-me-over sort of pitch, but it looks like a legitimate pitch now. I don't know. That's a tough one.
But I think Waka would be my game 3 at this point. I guess I'd go Wainwright for 4. I would hope at this point that they would have the sense to pull a starter relatively quickly, because you would have, obviously at that point, Lance Lynn in the bullpen. Regardless, whoever, as much as some of the pitchers haven't been super great, I think anybody who doesn't make the playoff rotation would, by definition, have to be in the bullpen. Like, you're not going to just not put them on the roster.
Yeah.
And then
get that Shelby Miller memorial spot. Oh man, that's the meme that will
the almost Michael Wacha.
Yeah, spot. Unfortunately, it wasn't his spot. He actually got used in the worst possible time. But that's we don't need to bring that up again.
Yeah, we
that horse is dead.
I feel like you'd say the horse is dead. It makes me think of like the Godfather and waking up by the horse's head thing. I feel like that's just be like you just waking up just in a terror at night, screaming about Michael Wacha coming in.
I do actually do that, yes. I'm like, why did you put him in?
Travis Ishikawa!
Yeah, that's literally, that is, yeah. I did that for weeks afterwards, and every once in a while I have those night terrors.
It's certainly a traumatic moment for us all, but...
Good thing I have Kane.
Yeah, on the, Kane being her dog, yes. For those who do not remember the name from the previous episode.
Oh, yeah. Kane the dog, yes.
Yes, but, okay, so... At this point, one of the welcome developments has happened was... It started off with a not welcome development, which was Stephen Piscotty and Jose Martinez each going on the disabled list. Piscotty looks like is going to probably be reactivated coming up pretty soon. Martinez, we're not super sure on. But as a result, Tommy Pham was called up from Memphis, a player that a lot of us thought was going to make the Cardinals out of spring training, and it ended up being Martinez who got that fourth outfielder spot. Which partially led to the Matt Adams experience, but it appears as though, I mean, Ledmus Diaz played left field last week. It appears that the Matt Adams experiment is completely over.
If that's the time, if you were going to play Matt Adams in left field, that would have been the time to do it.
Yeah,
that was the time that Matt Adams can play left field. And they
yeah, I think so. I even tweeted that out on the VEB account. I was like, I'm going to live to regret this, but I don't have a problem with Matt Adams playing left field here, but... Regardless, though, Tommy Pham was called up, as well as, there's been so many mixed reports on how to pronounce his name, and I'm trying to be very careful about it. Let's go with Magnerius here. That's, you know, I've heard Magnerius, I've heard Magnerius, I've heard Magnerii.
Yeah, Magnerii.
I've heard people say Mags, and I'm kind of, part of me worries that that's sort of like doing like the old Pittsburgh Pirates thing where they would call Roberto Clemente Bob Clemente because they were just trying to avoid pronouncing a name they didn't know.
Which, oh, Roberto?
That was a big thing in, like, Pittsburgh media in the 60s. I mean, that was before a lot of, like, the waves of, like,
Mags
Hispanic...
reminds me of an older woman's name. So I'm not really a fan of that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of...
I think I've heard Maggie, too, before. But regardless, Mr. Sierra. And, you know, there's no offense meant by the fact... I just haven't heard a conclusive way of how to pronounce his name. And once that becomes, I think, more established, I'm... want to learn his actual name. It's just been so many mixed reports, and that's a totally different discussion.
We're not experts on...
baseball.
Baseball, yeah. Or pronunciation, for that matter.
Yeah. But regardless, though, they've both played well. And Tommy Pham, I think his WRC plus at this point for the season is 212.
That's all right.
Which is really good. Like,
it's like 112% higher, better than average?
It's better than Mike Trout. He's literally been better than Mike Trout this season whenever he's played. And Sierra has been sort of a different role that he's had. And his hitting numbers at this point, it's mostly just been as a singles hitter. He isn't really...
It's kind of what we expected.
Yeah, and like Pham's displayed power. He's been the more complete player. Whereas Sierra's had a lot of speed and a lot of defense.
It's fun to watch, though.
It hasn't manifested itself in terms of, like, stolen bases, but in terms of base running, it's certainly there.
Going first to home in, like, 10 seconds? Yeah. That'll do.
Like, he's unquestionably the fastest player currently on the roster.
The fastest player on the roster in, like, 5 years, I'd say.
Yeah, Borges was fast, but...
Yeah, that's true. But we didn't really get to see Borges play very much.
Yeah, and we may not get to see Sierra play much coming up here.
Yeah.
What would you do as far, like, with Piscotty coming back up?
Oh, gosh.
And eventually Johnny Peralta coming back. There's a lot of roster decisions that have to be made. I know where I would go with this, and I'll...
You got to send a pitcher down, right? There's 13. Yeah. So.
Well, at this point, the question, I guess, is do you send a pitcher down, or do you send a pitcher, like... Gone.
Because, let's see, Sokolovich has no options left.
Yeah, I think the path of least resistance probably would be to try to send Sokolovich down, hope he clears waivers.
He won't.
He might. Like, people like Sokolovich mostly because we didn't see him that much. Therefore, it's sort of like the backup quarterback syndrome. You're going to like the thing that you don't see because you just assume that they're going to be awesome.
Fair enough, yeah.
And he struggled this year. I don't think that's necessarily a reflection on his true talent, just like I don't think his ERAs in past years were necessarily that either. But, like, you could try to send him down. You could get rid of Broxton. And I think I think Broxton is overly hated, but at the same time, I'm not sure what role he really has in the bullpen, because they're not really pitching him. Like, they're bringing him in whenever it's basically mop-up duty, and any pitcher can do that. You're not going to keep a guy along because he's good at pitching mop-up. That's something that literally anybody can do.
Daniel Descalso.
Yeah, you could throw a position player out there at that point, for all I care, but I think at this point, Tommy Pham has to stay. Like,
yes, yeah.
I was a strong proponent of Tommy Pham being on the major league club to begin with.
I was apathetic, but I...
Yeah.
My theory was play the hot hand, which is kind of a dumb thing to say.
But there's no question who the hot hand is at this point. It's Pham.
Tommy Pham is the hottest hand, so... Yeah.
And people don't like Tommy... Some people don't like Tommy Pham because he gets hurt a lot, which it's a fair criticism if the discussion were, do you want to extend Tommy Pham? But the discussion at this point... Like, what would be the point if a guy... If a guy is going to get hurt and you're worried about that and you think that's inevitable, that's all the more reason to keep him in the major leagues, because then you get that production out of him at the major league level rather than him playing in Memphis and getting hurt there, if you view that as an inevitability. I think Sierra is the more interesting player, because I've heard people suggesting that he should stay up, and
I think he needs...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's... Okay, the key here, I think, is that Sierra is 21 years old.
Right.
If Sierra were in his late 20s, if he were like a Gerard Dyson, like late bloomer type, I could see the argument for keeping a player in the major leagues as a situational player, but you have to believe that he could improve his offense. Mm-hmm. He's not just, like, because at this point, he has a high batting average, but it's because he's basically just been a slap hitter, which I could certainly see him being a true talent, like high BABIP guy, but
like
not...
Like Juan Pierre, kind of.
Yeah, but not as high as it's been. And before he made the major leagues, he had not played at a level higher than high A. And at this point, this is a really impressive tryout he's had. And I'm looking forward to keeping track of his development a lot more than I had been. And he's intriguing, but this wasn't even a guy who was being viewed as a top prospect. Like, Harrison Bader was no question the more highly regarded, considered polished outfield prospect. And granted, Bader's probably more of a corner outfielder, maybe along the lines of a Grichuk, where he could play center, but he's probably better suited for a corner. Sierra has the speed to play center. And again, it's exciting, but he can still improve. And once you have the full outfield, assuming that Grichuk, Fowler, and Piscotty are going to be the starting outfielder, Tommy Pham's the perfect guy to have as a fourth outfielder, and you could basically set it up so that every single guy plays a majority of the games. You just kind of shuffle guys in and out, especially if you have health concerns, particularly about Grichuk and then Piscotty coming off the DL. And I just don't see at that point what role Sierra would have other than just pinch runner and late defensive replacement. And that was what Peter Borges was going to be and never really materialized. But at least with Borges, it was worth keeping him around because at that point he was in his late 20s.
Right.
He wasn't going to improve with development in the minors in the same way that Sierra will.
Yeah, it's not fair to keep him up if he's not going to play.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like fans, for lack of a better term, tend to sort of over-fetishize fast players. And I think it's because of sort of lingering love towards the 80s
nostalgia.
Cardinals, people who expect, people keep comparing him to Willie McGee, which I think is a really weird comparison because Willie McGee hit home runs. It wasn't like he had no power whatsoever. At this point, Sierra has an ISO, I believe, of zero, which means he doesn't have any extra base hits. Let me check on that.
I thought he might have stretched something into a double. Like it was a single that he, or maybe they didn't count that. Maybe they called it an error, but I do remember him going to second base because someone took too long to throw the ball into the infield.
Yeah, he's had some very good base running moments.
But I'm not going to argue that it isn't fun. He is incredibly fun to watch on the base paths. And it's refreshing, to be honest, because the Cardinals are so poor at base running, to see someone that's actually good at it.
Well, they said that about Dexter Fowler, too, and then he got picked off on Friday.
Oh my gosh, I saw that.
Yeah. So Sierra, yep, he has an ISO of 0. He is...
must not have counted that as a double.
26 plate appearances, 9 singles, and 2 walks. At this point, I'm not even positive that he's a great defender. I'll trust people who say he is, but at this point, we just haven't had enough time to determine it from what we've seen in the majors. He had the most difficult catch I know that a Cardinals outfielder had made up to that point, and I think it was his first start, or maybe it was his second, but that's more a reflection on the Cardinals not being a great defensive team. Though they're getting better, and I think he's certainly an intriguing player to have, like, in September for call-ups, and you have an expanded roster, but yeah, at this point, I think you need, like, I would rather have, as much as I'm not sure about Johnny Peralta, I think that the possibility of him being, once he comes back from injury, like a viable pinch-hitting option. Like, at this point, I think Peralta's done as far as being the starting third baseman. I think Jed Jerko has clearly won that battle. Mm-hmm. Like, Jed Jerko's been, like, the best power hitter in baseball over the last year and a half. like that was a stat they showed yesterday. He literally has the most home runs. I'm not sure if it was per plate appearance or per at-bat, but regardless, like, he was number one and Giancarlo Stanton was number two.
Jed Jerko becoming, like, a key power hitter has been one of my favorite, like, yes, developments over the past year. Like, that just cracks me up. It entertains me beyond...
It's wonderful.
...explanation. Oh, I love it.
But, yeah, at this...
I kind of forget that he even is on the Cardinals, and then you bring him up, I'm like, oh, yeah.
And, like, he's great, too. Like, he's fantastic.
Oh, it just cracks me up, because I don't know. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. But, you know, that's pretty much all I have on the matter. I think that Sierra's a player to keep an eye on, but I think in terms of short to medium term, you know, maybe in a couple years, it'd be more his time to shine. But for now, I think you stick with Pham. Whenever Martinez comes back, you can have Martinez also on the roster, but I think at this point, Pham, and until he either cools down or until he gets hurt, you keep playing him pretty frequently. He doesn't have to start every single day, but play him a lot. And, you know, at this point, the Cardinals lineup, you look at it, and it's starting to really crystallize. And, like, at this point, who's the weak link in the lineup? I guess Diaz, because he hasn't been as good as he was last year. But he was
kind of had a rough...
Yeah.
A rough season so far.
But even he's shown power. It's not like
he's had his moments, but I think overall he's been replacement value or worse.
I mean, Molina had been kind of a weak link, and then he had 2 home runs yesterday, so who knows there. But I was just about ready to, like, start getting really negative on the Yadier Molina extension just from a baseball perspective, because Carson Kelly's been tearing the cover off the ball in AAA. But
that's awesome.
But when Molina hits 2 home runs, it's hard to get too mad. And they were, like, at least the one home run was, like, really just driven off the bat. It was sort of like a Matt Holliday-level home run where it's not, like, the high-arching Mark McGwire moonshot, but it's just, like, the straight-ahead. I guess, like, Pujols had that sort of thing, too, where it was just straight a power laser off the bat. Yeah, which I don't normally associate with, you know, modern-day Yadier Molina, but I'm not going to argue against it. But okay, so, you know, we've gone longer than I thought we were going to, but one more thing I think we should talk about at least briefly is that there's rumored changes in the rules of baseball. It was, a lot of it stemmed from the Cubs' 18-inning game against the Yankees last week. Which,
did the Cubs complain about that?
I know that, shockingly, they did complain about it.
That's so funny that they're becoming the complainers.
Yeah.
It cracks me up. Anyway, continue, sorry.
I think there's credence to the theory that Joe Maddon is just so used to being the underdog that now that he's clearly not the underdog, even when the Cubs had this loaded team that was favorites, they were still the Cubs and they hadn't won the World Series in over a century. So he could play off that underdog card. And whenever he was with the Rays, even when they were successful, they were small market. Mm-hmm. There's nothing underdog about them now, and he cannot stand it. And I love it. I just absolutely love it. But anyway, the rumors that were being floated about by Buster Olney were either that baseball could, in order to shorten games, either start instituting tie games after a certain number of innings. I think the number I've heard a lot is 12, so they would play 3 extra innings, and then at that point they would call it a tie, or they would go to World Baseball Classic rules, where you would start off the inning with a runner at second base.
What is the point of this?
To shorten games and to conserve player energy. I have a pretty controversial stance on this, so I'll let you go with whatever normie stance you have.
I think it's kind of dumb. Like, how often does it happen a season where that's going
to... They go, like, super extra innings?
Yeah. I think it happens, like, 3 or 4 times. And to, like, maybe once to a team. It just doesn't happen that often. And then you get to see weird baseball. And that's part of why you watch. I kind of like it.
Okay. So here's my stance, and I'm positive you're going to want to burn the witch on this one. So I'll, okay, I have my shoes on so I can dart out. My car's not too far away. Okay.
I have a dog, though.
Oh, goodness. No, Kane's on my side.
Yeah.
Maybe not on this issue, but in general, Kane loves me. But anyway, so the World Baseball Classic rule, I hate that rule. Don't do that. That's stupid. Like,
because
at that point, it ceases to be baseball. At that point, you're just dramatically changing the rules, like,
right.
And at that point a team can bunt the runner over and then sacrifice fly, and then you score a run with just the least amount earned you could possibly have, and I hate that. Ties don't bother me, like the idea of games ending in ties, and don't do a tie after 9 innings, but it, you know, after 12, at that point the weird baseball thing just doesn't really do as much for me. Like the position.
That's just when weird baseball is getting started. You know what they should do is just keep beer sales going.
That's kind of dangerous.
I'm just kidding. But that's the main problem, is that there's no beer left and the game is still going on.
I've never seen you drink a beer at a baseball game.
Oh,
I'm not
no,
sure.
I can't afford to drink beers at a baseball game.
Okay.
Come on. Who do you think I am?
But anyway, though, like the idea of ties just don't bother me that much, and I think the closest analogy I can think of to this would be, like, the NHL. Because the NHL had ties for a long time. And then they got rid of the tie for their overtime format. And, like, the overtime that they have now is they play 3-on-3 hockey rather than 5-on-5. It used to be 4-on-4, but they play that for 5 minutes. And that's fine because it's still more or less hockey. But then they do the shootouts after that.
I like the shootout.
I hate the shootout. I despise it. Because it's not hockey. At that point, you're basically doing the equivalent of like a home run derby to decide
a game.
In
soccer, they do shootouts.
I don't like it then either.
Nah.
I wish they would just play until somebody scores, at least.
That would be days sometimes.
Well, I would do that like for like championship matches. I don't mind the fact that they're like, I hate the idea that like a World Cup final is being decided by, you know,
especially
penalty
in
kicks.
Kind of soccer, is that basically. I don't know anything about soccer, but it just seems like the goalie kind of has just guesses.
Yeah.
Or at least hockey, it's like a move, you know, and the goalie is playing the... Anyway, but that's getting beyond the point. Continue.
Well, also the fact that in soccer, like, it totally eliminates the defense. Like, the goalie obviously still has a role in that, but, like, the backs don't really do anything at that point because they're usually not guys who are taking the penalty kicks. But that's... Like, the idea of games ending in ties, I don't think it destroys the game in any sort of way. That people will talk about it as being this great existential threat, but there's also a little bit of a boy who cried wolf thing where people say this about every little change. Like I mentioned before, the automatic intentional walks, people talking about like it destroying the fabric of the game, and I don't really see it that way. Like, certainly don't do ties or like the ghost runner thing or whatever. For postseason games, those games should go on as long as they have to, because at that point, those games matter too much to let any sort of, you know, gimmickry decide it. But when it comes to a regular season game, it's not about I mentioned this before, it's not about the toughness of the players, it's about the quality of play. And like, obviously, as Cardinals fans, we're okay with the fact that the Cubs got just completely spent playing an 18-inning game, but whenever a team plays that long, it means that their bullpen is just totally shot. It means that, you know, towards the end, they're resorting to position players pitching. They're resorting to... And people enjoy that, but I prefer that more in a blowout rather than an actual competitive game.
I just like weird baseball. There's no ties in baseball. Can't have a tie. That's like a thing. It is a fundamental thing.
Well, it did happen in the All-Star game that one time.
Yeah, because it ran out.
See, that annoyed me at the time. I think it more annoyed me because it was so, like, thrown together. Like, I don't want them to start calling ties in games without that actually being a rule, which is what they did during the All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
But It doesn't bother me, though I will absolutely say that I hate the idea of the runner on second determining it, because...
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
Like, that's too far removed from the overall flow of baseball, but to me it's also far removed from the flow of baseball if you have got, like, position players pitching, or you have sort of, like, mediocre hitting pitchers pinch hitting, things like that.
I saw someone float around the idea of letting players be re-entered into the game after 9 innings, which is kind of interesting to me, because that would also change kind of how you approached before you even went into extra innings.
Yeah.
Because, say, you could pinch run Yadier Molina, and maybe the game doesn't even get into extra innings because you're not afraid to take out your catcher in a tie game, you know what I'm saying, in the 9th inning type of thing.
Yeah, that would be an interesting idea. I feel like there's some sort of thing we're missing that would be a drawback to that, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I know. When they said it, I was trying to think what would be trying to think critically. I'm like, why would that be bad?
Well, I think any
maybe it makes games go longer is the potential chance for that, but
maybe a little bit. But I think if you have the best possible players, that increases the chances of scoring.
Right.
Because, like, pitchers are less likely to, and they could re-enter the game, but I think especially starting pitchers are less likely to re-enter the game at that point.
Because that's what I had said. The follow-up was that I guess pitchers wouldn't be allowed to re-enter the game because you don't want the awesome pitchers coming back. And my theory was that they wouldn't even, you could say everyone can re-enter the game, but pitchers probably wouldn't anyway, because once a reliever pitches their inning and then cools down, they're not, for safety reasons, aren't going to go back into the game anyway. So then you have mediocre pitchers that you're kind of not wanting to use versus the good hitters that are back. So
I've had a theory for a long time that baseball should, like, expand the active roster and basically do, like, what hockey does, where they have, like, scratches. We'd have, like, we'd have, like, 30 players on the team, but only 25 can dress. And at that point, you'd probably use 4 of those 5 scratches for starters who aren't pitching.
Yeah.
Or at least, like, 3 of them, probably. And maybe one is, like, an emergency.
I've thought of that, too, why more teams don't do that. That would be cool. Like, I like how hockey does that. Where you
it's probably a matter of, like, the union. They probably just don't want to have to pay additional players. Oh, it wouldn't be the union. It would be the owners.
They
don't want to have to pay additional players $500,000 to sit in the press box. But, yeah, that's my stance, my unpopular stance to ruin the sanctity of baseball.
Ties.
Yeah. The microphone's starting to fall over. We're starting to startle Kane, so I feel like that's probably our cue to wrap it up. We've gone on very much long enough, but
it was 2 weeks worth of...
It was. We had a lot of content, a lot of...
Really, like, 2 35-minute episodes.
Yeah, a lot of serious and non-serious discussion. It looks like total runtime is going to be about 69 minutes, which I'm sure will delight some of our less mature listeners, but...
Which is most of them, probably. No offense to the mature listeners out there.
Yeah, there's some sophisticated listener right now who doesn't get what we're talking about, which is probably for the best, but... Anyway, Heather, obviously, we've mentioned your writing several times throughout the episode. Where could we find that writing?
You can find it at vivaalbertos.com on SB Nation. I write under LIL_scooter93, which is also my Twitter handle. And also you can send me emails at that address at msn.com.
Yep, you can also read my writing at vivaalbertos.com. Go ahead and follow Viva Albertos on Twitter, at Viva Albertos, facebook.com/VivaAlbertos, and subscribe to the podcast. I don't think we mentioned this often enough, but, you know, if you enjoy the podcast, you know, tell a friend if you think they'd be interested. Give you something to discuss. You can discuss how awesome of a podcaster John is and how Heather's also okay.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Well, I think you're just accepting them. Well, no, don't accept that.
I mean, I'm not great.
Okay, fine. But regardless, you can tell a friend and all that stuff, and write us nice reviews. And Cardinals start a 2-game series coming up tomorrow from when we're recording this. Perhaps today, by the time you're listening to it, perhaps you're listening to this years in the future, and this is perhaps this is the one thing that survived the nuclear apocalypse. In which case, I think this was the thing to survive.
Yes,
and I'm proud of it. And yeah, thank you for listening.